welcome to the Gentle Rebel podcast. My name is Andy Mort, and this is a show about engaging with creative spirit, deep sensitivity, and playfulness to explore our creative human potential in a world that often struggles to slow down. Do you experience harmonious passion or bore out when trying to explore and develop areas that matter most in life to you? We chatted about this in a Haven community discussion, Cotter, a couple of months ago, and I really want to share some of the ideas that we discussed in that conversation in this podcast episode. I think it's a really useful area to consider when practicing a new craft or developing new skills and habits and those kinds of things. And I think it's really relevant as well to highly sensitive people who are learning about the trait of sensory processing sensitivity and finding ways to explore and embrace creative potentials in light of it. We're going to think about the role of play, deliberate play, in keeping us engaged and energized. We'll consider the differences between burnout and bore out and explore obsession versus passion, how hustle and grind culture can contribute to boredom, and why purpose and passion are not necessarily things to worry about finding, despite the messages that we are constantly fed by mainstream narratives. So the words hidden potential really caught the sleeve of my attention when I saw Adam Grant's most recent book. Really gave me pause to reflect on the role of high sensitivity in human flourishing and how often we try ignoring and hiding it from view when it comes to the collective experience of humanity. But there are reasons to believe that without access to our sensitivity as individuals and as collectives, as communities, we end up actually turning away from the subtle, deeper, and more beautiful aspects of human potential, not to mention, you know, depths of insight and sensory intelligence that can help us better survive and flourish as a species. I'm going to use some of the ideas in chapter 4 of Hidden Potential to frame this episode. And that chapter starts with a quote by Bernard de Koven, who says, "It is neither work nor play, purpose nor purposelessness that satisfies us. It is the dance between." So as we start, I should probably give some kind of definition of bore out, because that's a word that's going to come up a few times during the next half an hour or so. At least in the way that I'm using it in this episode, bore out is the emotional deadening that you feel when you're understimulated to the point of disconnection. It can also happen through sensory overload, which hits a switch off button. An example of this for some people might be when you're watching maybe like an action movie or a superhero movie, where there's so much stimulation that it sort of loses its meaning. It becomes meaningless and you don't really care what's going on. It's not that you're necessarily overwhelmed by that sensory overload and in need of time to recover from it. Rather, you're sort of underwhelmed by something that just has failed to connect with you, because it's like, oh, it's just so much. I'm out. And so bore out often occurs when we lose touch with a sense of purposeful connection and intrinsic joy with the task at hand. And in the case of practice, it turns into an obsessive slog rather than a meaningful journey towards progress and growth. So the 10,000 hours rule is the idea that it takes about 10,000 hours of practice to master a skill. Well, it's really not that simple in reality, and actually the theory is not necessarily very scientifically proven. It's clear that deliberate practice is valuable when it comes to improving skills in predictable tasks with consistent moves. Adam Grant talks about, you know, swinging a golf club, solving a Rubik's Cube, playing a violin, those kinds of things. The things that, you know, the so-called muscle memory is developing, and then the more that we repeat something over and over, the more competent we get and the better we become at that thing. But when we treat it as something that we've just got to repeat and repeat, practice can create bore out. It can extinguish passion and cause us to even resent things that maybe used to be exciting and joyful, things that, you know, we started because it's like, I'm kind of drawn towards this thing. You know, maybe you can think of an example of this where you used to love doing a particular activity or hobby, but then it started to become a slog. And this is one reason why the quality of our teachers, our coaches, our mentors really matters when we set out to explore and uncover our potential, improve skills, learn crafts without becoming bored by them. Likewise, with certain projects, you know, there's what's often described as that the messy middle of a project where it's often just a case of like, you just got to do the work. You just got to, you know, get your head down and get on with it. And you're maybe too far in to feel the excited joy that you had at the start, where it's like, oh, this is new, this is exciting. But you're not far enough so that you can see the light at the end of the path. And so it can be really challenging to keep going at that moment. It can be like, oh, what's the point? This is really boring. Which is why it helps to have motivating people around us and those who can help us figure out maybe how to bring some deliberate play into doing the work. You know, deliberate play isn't about avoiding the work. It's not about avoiding doing the sort of training drills or the fitness sessions, whatever it is that kind of that work requires from us. It's about making those things more enjoyable. It's about making them more engaging so that actually we sort of get the work done without feeling like it's a slog, without going down that line where we end up maybe boring out or burning out. I kind of had an experience like this when I was a kid learning the piano. You know, I've always loved music, but found that my passion was sucked dry by piano lessons. You know, they felt like punishment, to be honest. And there was aspects of these lessons, aspects of the way that the piano was taught, where, you know, be doing scales and technical exercises, and they were run like drills. It was like, keep going until you get them right. And then when you get them right, we'll do another one. And you're constantly always on this treadmill of being unable to do the thing that you're doing. And it was boring. You know, they would have been the words that I used. It's like, oh, I hate piano. I hate playing the piano. It's boring. I hate piano practice. It's so boring. But it didn't need to be. And it's amazing. There are some people who fall into that trap, aren't they? Like perpetuating or peddling that story that, well, some things are just not meant to be enjoyed. You're not supposed to like it. It's piano practice. And it was different when I learned the drums. You know, there was some less enjoyable aspects of learning the drums, like the technical exercises, the rudiments, the sight reading, things like that. Necessary parts for passing exams, which is something that I wanted to do. But I found that, so I had three drum teachers growing up, and they were all really good at coming up with ways to incorporate rudiments and those other technical things into other settings. You know, finding songs, finding pieces of music where the drummer was actually doing those things and then giving me stuff to learn that meant I was accidentally practicing. I was accidentally doing those core elements along the way. But actually, it was really fun because I was learning these other things as well. And it turned out that, you know, the rudiments, the technical stuff wasn't actually as scary or as hard as they first appeared to be either. And when I could feel that growth happen, when I kind of play witness to the progress that was going on, and that sense of like, oh, I can do this thing now that I couldn't do, you know, this time last month, whatever. That really fueled and sustained the passion as well. I didn't have to be nagged to play and practice drums. I wanted to. I enjoyed playing. I don't think I ever practiced piano by choice until I finished having lessons. And then I started playing and writing songs all the time. Like, you can get me away from the piano. Learning music doesn't have to be boring. Maybe you can think of an experience like this where you reached bore out. What was the story attached to it? You know, I've heard people talk about it in relation to things like health and fitness as well, you know, whether it's or kind of eating better, things like that. I mean, the reason that I quit a football team when I was a teenager was because the coaches insisted, it was when I'd first joined this team, and they had this idea that the team was not very fit. So they decided that, okay, we're going to leave the balls locked away in the cupboard or wherever they were keeping them, and we'll do nothing except for run, push-ups, sit-ups, stretches, like all of these kind of things on the field. Actually pulled one of my quads during that, ended up quitting after playing just one match, in large part because I really could think of better ways to spend a Tuesday evening than running around a cold field being told to go faster and go further and us not having any footballs. It was like, I'm here to play football. And I really honestly think they could have used deliberate play to serve that fitness goal. You know, bring the balls out, make it fun, add some elements of play. Unfortunately, they obviously had a very limited pool of options to pick from when it came to thinking about fitness work. It was like, okay, well, if we need to get the team fit, therefore we just need to make them run. That's it. I think they only knew one way. And this is why creativity is such a vital thing for everybody to connect with, isn't it? Because it gives us access to more options when it comes to approaching whatever it is that we are wanting to develop, wanting to improve, wanting to change, wanting to grow. You know, getting fit doesn't actually have to be boring. So how does bore out differ from burnout? I'm not sure I've come across any truly satisfying distinctions between these things yet, because I think there's flavors of each in both. But it's generally delineated by, I think, stimulation. So burnout coming from a kind of long-term overstimulation, and bore out emanating from long-term understimulation. Control is also a big factor. So burnout often happening when life is in the hands of outside forces that are demanding more and more, and you just cannot sort of catch a break, essentially. You're unable to choose to stop. And if you do slow down or do rest, it doesn't prevent the things from piling up. So even when you are trying to relax, you just know you've got this sense that everything is building up on top of you. On the same coin, bore out might be the inability to control the dial to make things more interesting and more stimulating. You know, you might be in a situation where you're doing something that you are just disconnected from, and over time you just feel empty and soulless when kind of going to that place or doing that thing. Perhaps the comfort zone or the capacity zone idea is somewhere to frame these ideas as well. Burnout coming from too much time in our stretch or panic zone, so being constantly outside of that area of comfort, but without ongoing conditions for sort of preparation and recovery for those times where we are stretching ourselves. And then bore out coming from, you know, no time in our stretch zone where our capacity has the opportunity to grow and our skills are able to develop. So I guess bore out and burnout are similar spaces in the context of those training examples as well. You know, being forced to do the technical work on the piano, and it's never good enough. It could always be faster, more expressive or whatever. Burnout comes from never being able to reach a point of refuge. There's always another goal to hit. So relaxation isn't about doing nothing. It's about being plugged into activities, endeavors, and personal projects that give you a sense of connection and purpose. I think I've probably talked about this at some point before, but I remember as a kid, probably between about 7 and 10 years old, we'd often go on camping holidays to places like France, Italy, Switzerland. And some of the areas that we stayed in southern France would observe siestas, where campsite facilities, local businesses, everything was kind of shut down for an hour or two, sometimes even longer. And everywhere would just be really quiet and still during that time in the afternoon. Which I freaking love that idea now. But at the time, I found it really boring. It would just be sort of like, it would drag on. And I'd be really restless and irritable. And I want to do stuff. I don't want to sleep or read. But then I started over time to kind of find my way to little creative projects. So I'd fill notebooks with Stockport County's football fixtures for the following season. You know, making individual pages for each game and put spaces to record all the statistics, you know, who's going to be the referee, like all the yellow cards, goal scorers, all that sort of stuff. I've never actually, funnily enough, I never ended up, I might have sort of done the first couple of games of the season, but those books, I don't know, they were more the thing that I just was able to do during the summer on those holidays. It was, that's what made it meaningful. I didn't actually need to fill them out. Or I'd write stories or draw comics, things like that. And it was much more relaxing to create than it was to try and sit there doing nothing. You know, we've probably all experienced boredom when relaxing in the wrong way, haven't we? When we've had enough passive rest and it's time to plug into something meaningful. And this is what happened for many people during the first lockdown in the pandemic. You know, after the initial period of maybe just sort of doing very little, binge watching some TV shows, unwinding in front of the TV, people began to get creative. They learned skills, they began new hobbies, they dove into projects that maybe they've been wanting to do for ages but not had the time or the capacity for until now. Or maybe just completely brand new ideas had occurred to them, like, oh, I've got all this time, I'm going to try this out. Obviously, this was not possible for everyone. This was not the experience for everyone. But at scale, there was this general trend in the direction of creative relaxation. And it spoke of this part of the human spirit that will create because we are a creative species. You know, people did things just for the sake of it. And furlough schemes meant that for many people, they could do this while being paid by jobs that they couldn't actively do during that time. So it was a chance to spend a good amount of time doing things without needing to make money from them. And that changes everything as well. You know, creativity truly flourished as a result of this. There were many really interesting, playful, adventurous undertakings that went on during that time. What do you like to do to plug into a spirit of creative rest? Adam Grant says, to stop passion turning into a grind, regular breaks are vital. Play is not a meaningless activity. It connects us with joy and accidental mastery. Rest is not a waste of time. Breaks reset our attention and allow ideas to incubate and integrate. Obsession sees rest as a backward step that causes us to fall behind. Excellence requires exhaustion. Harmony sees rest as generative and sustaining. So a toxic culture would say you earn a break. A good culture would say you need a break. A vibrant culture say you want a break. How do these distinctions speak to you? The frames and the words that we use around play, around rest, around these areas of well-being are really important. You know, what are the values that we hold around this stuff? That makes a huge difference. So we've talked about the link between boredom and understimulation. But what if it's too much stimulation that bores us? Not in a kind of habituation sense, like the hedonic treadmill where, you know, you search for more exciting stimulation and then, you know, you get used to that. So now you need like even more stimulation to kind of get you interested. And so you get bored, that your sort of barrier, your bar for boredom is higher and higher, or lower and lower. Which way around? I don't know which way around it would be, but like you get bored of things that would have been more exciting. Like it's not that, but in the sense of being overwhelmed to the point of disconnection. When we are disconnected from presence and possibility, we get bored. Now, I've been thinking about this in relation to social media algorithms this year. I've been exploring alternative platforms to Twitter over the past, I don't know, 6 months or so, probably more. I tried Threads, but I noticed a deep frustration with the algorithm. And I just keep forgetting to log in. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot I was trying that out. And I think it's partly because I bore out. You know, lots of creators I've seen complaining about algorithms on Threads and on YouTube, like everything really, because the things they make don't get seen by people. But my biggest bugbear around algorithms is that I don't get to see everybody, especially everybody I've chosen to follow. And I notice a sense of overstimulation through sameness. And I wrote a post about this a little while ago, which I'm going to read out now because it's kind of fun. So algorithms killed something in social media. When Twitter turned algorithms on and changed the organic network into one with an ever-evolving monster with an insatiable appetite for our engaging content, no longer could we start conversations with those who followed us. We had to earn attention by being as appealing, read, provocative / emotional as possible. For some, the most frustrating aspect of social media algorithms is how hard it is to reach others. For me, it's how hard it is to be reached by posts that give me a richly diverse range of reasons to be joyful and hopeful. The algorithms are often so sensitive to what they think we need that they overwhelm us with more of what we already have in our bowl. It's like you're at a buffet filled with diverse and unfamiliar foods. The algorithm follows you and watches you as you explore what's on offer. Something piques your curiosity and catches your attention enough to make you pause. Ah, I'll give that a go, you think, adding a spoonful to your bowl. The algorithm clicks its fingers and suddenly the whole buffet table changes. Quick, he wants porridge, fill the table with porridge. So out in the kitchen, the creators are busy making porridge. He loves porridge. Quick, every chef in the kitchen pours another bag of oats into their many pans. And they all run out to fill the serving receptacles on the table. The one who gets there first, they've probably paid their monthly subscription for a super fast heating fire hob, says, I see you have porridge. If you like porridge, you should try porridge. But I have porridge, you say. Not like this porridge. Yeah, it looks just like that porridge in my bowl. A crowd of porridge creators emerges from the kitchen and marches towards you. You'll love porridge if you love porridge. Well, yeah, you're not saying anything. Suddenly your desire for porridge fizzles out. Enough already. Okay, I hate porridge, you shout to get some peace. Excuse me, a voice emerges from behind you. If you hate porridge, you'll love my anti-porridge porridge. Join us in the stand against porridge. What is it? You ask curiously. Well, they declare confidently, it's not porridge. Oh, yeah. My biggest concern is numbness. The algorithms have a numbing effect. They breed indifference and numbness through overexposure and productive commodification of everything. They're training us to see social relations as transactional negotiations and sales pitches. Algorithms make it hard because they overwhelm the senses with a compressed view of humanity. They deliver what they assume we want, taking us deeper into the like mind. But they can't provide nuance, variety, or topics we have shown few previous references to or interests in. They're the complete opposite of an authentic social experience with strangers. As someone who loves to connect dots and find unexpected creative corridors to explore, algorithms are a direct obstacle to creativity. They prevent the weird and the wonderful combinations of disparate, unrelated forces from smushing together unexpectedly. They turn a beautifully diverse, contradictory, imperfect, technical world of collective potential into a monochromatic list of individuals trying to sell their services to people who sit in the same superficial boxes as us. Maybe I'm hoping for the impossible, but I don't want to live in a chamber that echoes with nothing but the sound of porridge. So yeah, the point is, bore out comes through the way that we structure and value things as a society and culture. The things we come to agree on in that sense, maybe consciously, most of the time unconsciously or subconsciously. Algorithms create it because they give us more of what we already have. They understimulate us at the level of inspiration while overwhelming our senses with this constant flood of content. The same kinds of messages, the same politics, the same ways of seeing things. And this can make us feel small. If you're trying to create stuff in a certain field or you're trying to develop a certain craft or whatever, it feels demoralizing at times to be shown this constant flow of people who are doing similar things to you but doing them better. And it also siphons us into boxes where it's harder and harder to do the truly creative thing, to connect dots with other disparate and diverse styles, voices, and ideas, which we stumble upon by chance, because the algorithms take those opportunities away. They take away that chance. Meaning is so often generated by unexpected happenings, coming across an idea that is totally left field to you, something you've not really considered before, something you've not noticed, seeing things you don't normally see. But in a world of consumption through algorithmic technology, these chances are fewer and fewer. We become more burned out and more bored out. So let's turn to passion as we think about this. So obsessive passion, the relentless pursuit of an activity for the sake of a desired, often hazily defined or ever-changing outcome to the cost of all other things. The obsessively passionate person's mind is fixed on the work, and it's hard to know who they are outside of the obsessive passion. It's usually underpinned by an adaptive quest for belonging. So the quest to gain approval, to gain external validation, acceptance from someone else, etc. Harmonious passion, on the other hand, is an integrated activity that is highly valued and engaged in freely for the sake of improving, growing, and flourishing. It's harmonious because it's an expression of life's bigger symphony. It's linked to flow state, which occurs when we experience intrinsic connection to the thing, rather than that drive for extrinsic rewards or validation. There was a study of concert pianists that Adam Grant cites, who attained international acclaim before turning 40. And it turns out that few were obsessed with their craft. In fact, early on, most practiced the piano for just an hour a day, and they weren't raised by controlling, dominating drill sergeants. Their passion ignited, and parents and teachers responded with the conditions to maintain the motivation and enthusiasm. They practiced not because they had to, but because they were interested. They enjoyed working with the teacher. They wanted to explore, to play, to improve. It's kind of the opposite of what I was describing earlier. And I wonder if you can think of an experience or a teacher, especially, who encouraged your excitement for a particular activity, or subject, or craft. You know, maybe we've all got those teachers that we can think of from school who turned our interest into a passion, who maybe even sparked a passion because of the way that they held the subject that they taught. We've got a strange relationship with many of these ideas in modern society. I want to talk about, you know, our hustle and grind obsession, which seems to have grown and grown in recent years. And I was looking at a popular blog post by Gary Vaynerchuk, which he published in 2017, so a little while ago now, and it was called Hustle, the Cure for Those Who Complain. And in it he wrote, if you want bling bling, if you want to buy the jets, if you want to have fancy clothes, then you need to put in the work. It's the cost of entry. It's the only variable that you can actually control. You can't control where you are from or how much money your parents had when you were born. You can't control what neighborhood you're from. The only thing you can control is what you do with your time. And because of the internet and Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, there are so many more opportunities for you to make something happen. Nowadays, you can literally work from your phone. You don't need to have an office or a job to get moving. You can work from anywhere, anytime, for free. And so this final part is what Byung-Chul Han writes about in his book, The Burnout Society, really as a leading cause of burnout in what he describes as achievement society, the critique of current, the way things currently are. We're living in this achievement society, he talks about. And he writes, the complaint of the depressive individual, nothing is possible, can only occur in a society that thinks nothing is impossible. No longer being able to be able leads to destructive self-reproach and auto-aggression. The achievement subject finds itself fighting with itself. The depressive has been wounded by internalized war. Depression is the sickness of a society that suffers from excessive positivity. It reflects a humanity waging war on itself. And I think those two passages kind of sit together quite effectively. You know, there's a chapter in the Burnout Society book about the overlaps and the antagonisms between burnout and boredom and this positivization of life, this obsessive positivization where nothing is impossible, all things are on the table, where we are all brands. We can be working all the time. There's no escape from this injunction from capitalism to hustle, to grind, to compete, and to keep up. Now, the world that Vaynerchuk proposes, I mean, it doesn't sound like a recipe for happiness, recipe for particular meaning. And maybe it's not meant to be, but the pursuit of that stuff like the bling, the clothes, buying a football team, sounds like these are aspirations for, towards happiness rather than, you know, moral obligations and responsibilities. It's not like he's saying you have a moral obligation to buy bling or to buy clothes, so therefore you should work hard. So if you do as he says, you've got to define what you want and why. Then you need to take action in pursuit of that what or why and be able to explain why you did the things you did. Hustle is really working day in and day out when no one is looking. It's about what you did from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep. I wonder what your why would be and what you believe the things you want will make possible for you. And so I was just struck that this blog post really aggressively points out that hustle is what you need to do instead of watching the latest episode of House of Cards. Did you eat lunch with your friend, he asks. Did you take 2 hours to respond to an email? Did you call your girlfriend from 7 till 8? Did your three meals take up to 2 to 3 hours of your time? Did you walk your dog? What did you do? If you're honest with yourself, I think that a lot of you will find that you didn't work that hard. All in all, my guess is that most people in a traditional 9 to 5 work 3 to 4 hours a day. They take lunch, check email, spend 20 minutes on Facebook here, 30 minutes on BuzzFeed there, and have 2 30-minute meetings that could have been cut to 5. It's just the truth. So there's a lot of contradictory messaging in there. And beneath the tone, I think he's saying, don't complain about things you're choosing to avoid or outcomes that you're actively encouraging through your actions. And I think it's, again, kind of makes sense, kind of quite an obvious thing. But I think I would also ask the question, what might it be telling you about what you really want or about your relationship with what you think you want, but are kind of putting off by watching TV, taking hours to eat food, responding to email, talking on the phone, whatever. Maybe these goals, these aspirations that we believe that we have are the reasons we're not working towards them because they're boring. They don't work. They're not going to bring the thing that we're told they will. And we know that deep down. Harmonious passion is about contributing and connecting, flowing in sync with the sense that what we are doing actually matters in some way. It's bigger than us. It's more than that pursuit of the hedonic pleasures and the accumulation of stuff. But rather than being more laser focused on those kind of hustle goals, what if we shifted our orientation to one of openness, creative exploration, playful experimentation? Take note from some of the world's most successful artists, sports people, educators. It's not about the hustle as much as it is about that dance that Bernard de Koven described. It is neither work nor play, purpose or purposelessness that satisfies us. It's the dance between. We don't come up with our purpose before we begin exploring. Purpose becomes the story we can see once the journey unfolds. You know, when we watch a biopic or read a biography, we see stories of somebody's life through a lens of inevitability. It's like that person was always on the trajectory towards the destination that we know comes later. But that destiny was not set in stone. It's just where things went. We might hear the stories told by others that involve luck, maybe bad fortune, dead ends, chance encounters that lead to a particular path being forged in response, and that being the path that changes everything in a positive way. And we might believe that, you know, this is the choice we need to make. We need to do the same thing as they did. But then we end up disappointed when it feels different to how it appeared when we read about their life. Sounds a bit cliche and twee, but the truth is, We all have a unique path that doesn't feel neat and smooth. Things don't go to plan. We are forced into undesirable changes at times. Things we wish wouldn't happen will happen. Things we don't expect to happen will happen. And things we expect to happen won't happen. This is true for everyone. Our sense of purpose is what we start to see as we look back through our stories. It's the spirit, the endeavor, the strength, the moments of courage, the choices, the energy that we bring to turning our vision and values to life in different ways. That sense of alienation, disconnection, atomization, loneliness contribute to burnout. The idea that we're alone in our endeavors, it's us against everybody else. That by taking time to rest, we are letting the opposition in. We're falling behind. It's absolutely exhausting. And this is a big part of why I built and really, really value the Haven. It's one of the things that I love about our community there, where it's kind of an opportunity to just step away from all of that messaging. It's a place of gentle inspiration, encouragement, support. It's not the kind of place that where we're like, oh, let's try squeezing all the members into this mold of whatever identity that we're trying to create everybody in the likeness of. It's rather somewhere that everybody can find the space and time to figure out and play with their own mold, to work out, okay, what is it that matters to me? What do I want my life to reflect? What values are important to me? And to just start to then be able to embody these things with the confidence of creative spirit. You can learn more about our community there at the-haven.co. You'll find a link in the show notes as well. If you've resonated with anything in this episode, I would love to hear from you. You can drop a comment below or send me a message on social media or through the contact form over at andymort.com. And that's it. I have, nothing more to say on this for now. But I will be back again next time with another episode of the Gentle Rebel podcast. And until then, remember that you are an artist. The world needs your art. Now go and make somebody's day. Bye-bye.